So I'm going to jump right into it today because I've got quite a bit of slides that we're going to try not to go too fast through, but there's quite a bit of material for today's lecture, which is on the construction of my house, Villa Vuoto. If you recall, just real briefly, the last 3 weeks we've kind of been building up to this point, looking at the design process over the last 3 weeks. And so today we're going to see how that actually manifests in the construction of the house. Before we get into that though, as I mentioned last week, the last lecture, which is in 2 weeks from today, we're going to have at my house. I think from looking at the sign-up sheets, I think the same time slot seems to work the best. So it would be at 12:30, 12:30 to 2. But what I'm going to do is, knowing that some people can't make it necessarily at that time, you're welcome to come by the house before or after that. I'll be at the house, and so if you come earlier in the day or later in the day, you're welcome to do that if you'd like to just see the house. And then in addition to that, those that can't make the last lecture, I'm going to try to make that available to you because I'm going to present that at the house. So if you could, like on the break or after class sometime, come up and talk to me about how I can get that lecture to you. I'm going to try to record it, email, whatever is the easiest way to get that to you. But just let me know so that way I can figure out who I need to send it to. So with that, let's get right into it. So in June of 2000, we found this lot in Franklin Park, which is north of the city, about a 20-minute drive up right off of the Wexford exit, off of 79. And when we found this lot here that you're seeing, it's the end of a cul-de-sac here on the left-hand side. And at the time that we found the lot, it was about a 4-acre lot. It was mostly wooded and sloped. I mean, there wasn't a flat area on the lot, and there wasn't a clear area either. Most of the interior just pretty much looked like this, which excited me because I was definitely looking forward to having the wooded setting. And in particular, there was a variety of different trees, a lot of the native species as far as maples and cherries, but what I really enjoyed were the sassafras, because the sassafras were these kind of tall, slender trees that would grow kind of irregular in shape, just very sculptural. And so we sited the house on the property, trying to take advantage of some of the more unique characteristic trees surrounding the house. And then once we did find the lot, we spent quite a bit of time just kind of digesting the lot before we really move forward. And so the design, if you recall from last week, the design process from this point was about 2 years before we broke ground. So we spent about 2 years really getting familiar with the lot, going out there on weekends, kind of just sitting and observing the different kind of wildlife activity that was going on in the area, but also just trying to get a feel for it so that way we could locate the house within the lot with the orientations that would be advantageous. And if you recall back from last week, this was the scheme that I'd been working out for some designs prior to finding the lot, but once we located the lot and became familiar with it, this was the first scheme that I'd worked through. And this is kind of like a bubble diagram floor plan showing a house that kind of wraps around kind of an open court, with the thought of trying to create this space that would be exterior of the house, but take advantage of, again, these views of the wooded setting. Here's an elevation of that that scheme. And then from that point, that continued, as if you recall from last week, continued through multiple iterations until eventually it started to solidify into something that I thought had some merit. And so then that's when I started modeling it three-dimensionally in the model that I brought last week, in quarter scale, a framing model, as you're seeing here. And then this is really where I fine-tuned and refined all the specific of the way that the house is laid out as far as the room orientations, the windows, taking again advantage of these views. But all of that was kind of worked through in a three-month period with the scale model. And again, this is all in reference to the property. So this slope that you're seeing here at the base of the model is in reference to the hillside. And then finally, after getting the model finalized to the point where I was ready to then transpose that into two-dimensional drawings that I could use to send out for bidding the work with the subcontractors like the electrician, plumber, framers, that type of thing. I did one kind of last iteration of a quick sketch of the exterior, just again convey it, the idea to my wife as well as some of the subcontractors. But one of the key things that happened in this last iteration was kind of the removal of this exterior room that we talked about briefly last week, which was it was the dining room for the house, but also more day-to-day would be the studio space where we would work myself as well as my wife and kids working on creating various things. And so this kind of removal and absence of this space that then became exterior became this exterior courtyard that was in that earlier bubble diagram. And also to that point, one thing that will be kind of, you'll see a theme today as we go through the construction here, is that it's this idea of trying to keep myself open to change in knowing that, like, even though I had a design worked out pretty solidly in the process, in this case, this studio came out because at this point, when I created this rendering, I had gotten some of the bids back, including the steel bid. If you recall back, this dining room was this kind of Frank Gehry Guggenheim type sculptural figure that was going to be made out of steel in a very similar process to the way Gehry built the Guggenheim Museum. All of that came back much more exorbitant than what I was planning. Certainly didn't have in the budget. So I just took it out. And it was this thing of just not being tied to any one thing. Everything was on the table as I went through, not only this point, but I tried to maintain that type of mindset going through even the construction of the house. As things developed, going through the construction, if something made more sense to do something other than what I'd planned, I'd pivot quickly.
I'm just curious. I went through this process with my wife. I'm curious as to how your wife was involved in all of this and how that kind of worked, because it can be tricky.
It can definitely be tricky. And so... And actually, that's a great point. It's funny, but it's salient, because before coming back to Pittsburgh, my wife coming back to Pittsburgh, I didn't grow up here, but she grew up in this area, which is why we came back this way. We were living out in Los Angeles, and at the time that I was out there, I had to put in a certain amount of time before I could get licensed. And so the architect that I was working for out there, I came to realize... this architect, she also did strictly residential work, which is what I wanted to do with my own practice. But I came to find out through her that, take this grain of salt because this is Southern California, roughly about half of the projects that she worked on over the years would end up in divorce before the house would be completed. And so it was a significant thing. And so that kind of lesson for me told me that as an architect, not only managing the project of getting the house built, but managing the relationships of the... When you're dealing with a house, you're dealing with two clients, generally speaking, as compared to like a commercial project where you might have like one point person that you're dealing with. But in a house, you have these two clients, and more often than not, they don't agree on many different things, everything from the budget to the color of their bedroom. And so trying to find a middle ground or trying to find compromises is really the skill of an architect that's successful at doing residential work. And so I very quickly learned from that that this is really where I needed to focus. And so And also, you know, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that aspect of it, is trying to find a way to navigate that. And so with my own house, applied some of those lessons in trying to, you know, keep my wife happy with the results. Fortunately, you know, she's an amazing woman, to where she only put three requirements on me for the entire house from the onset, which was great, because then it kind of, because, you know, she realized that this was a significant thing for me. I was trying to take this and develop a practice from this as kind of like a launching pad, being new to Pittsburgh, having really no contacts when I arrived here. And so, you know, she realized that, but at the same time, she had to live in it. So, you know, there were certain lines that she would draw. The three, real quickly, I'll go into them here. One is, might take me a minute to remember. So on our honeymoon, we went, which we'll see next week's lecture, we'll see a little bit more of this. We went to Capri in, on our honeymoon, and we went into the Blue Grotto. And so, but one of the things that she loved about it was our hotel had an outdoor terrace that overlooked the Mediterranean, which is, as you can imagine, pretty stunning setting. And so she wanted to kind of recreate that feeling off our bedroom. I couldn't like bring the Mediterranean Sea to Pittsburgh, but I could at least try to have some of those aspects of an outdoor terrace, which you're seeing right here. This is the off the bedroom door here, that kind of looked across the valley in the same way. And so this goes back to the first lecture with the spatial relationships, that despite there's no body of lake there, the way that the contour is formed, it has a similar feel to the way the expanse of the Mediterranean is within Capri. Another thing is that I let her have control of the color palette because she's very good with color. And so she worked out, as you'll see here today, the colors inside and outside as you go through the house. And I'll have to think about the third one. I'll come back to that one.
I have a question about zoning.
Yes.
Did you have to go before a zoning board?
I did not, no. We were on a little cul-de-sac. Really the only covenants that were written into our deed was that we had to have a carriage light at the end of our drive, which I failed to put in. And also we couldn't subdivide the lot. It was a 4-acre lot, and we couldn't subdivide it, so and we couldn't build more than one structure. And so I haven't broken that, so. One for two, exactly. Let's see here. June of 2000, so in July of 2002, so 2 years later, it was when we arrived at this, after we found the lot. So 2 years after that, we kind of landed on a house that we were ready to kind of move forward with. So we went out to the lot, we found a location, we tried to find a clearing as much as possible in there so we could take down as few trees as possible in putting the house in, and then so then we taped off an area. The stuff with inside this tape had to be cleared, and we cut down the first trees here in August 7th, and then I had the excavator scheduled for the 16th to come in and start excavating, but on the 16th we ended up rushing to the hospital because my wife was delivering our first child. And so we decided, I got the call on the way to the hospital, because I was supposed to meet the excavator out there in the morning to start digging. He was wondering where I was. I told him to go ahead and start digging anyways, because I thought it'd be nice to kind of have the house start on the same day that our first son was born. Also, before we get into it, just kind of for your reference, I'll give you just a real kind of overview here of some of the interior spaces. This lower level here is the main living level here. This is the front door that takes you into the living room, just straight ahead through the front door there. This little window here is a powder room off the living room. These series of windows is the kitchen, which is also open to the living room. The first floor is kind of an open floor plan. As you go upstairs to the second floor level is where the bedrooms are. This is our son that was born. His bedroom is right here. His His, our second son is just beyond this bedroom on behind it. And then over here is the main bedroom for my wife and I, which from there walks through a walk-through closet here that arrives at the master bathroom right here above.
Before you change, what's happening there, that point on the ones above the deck?
This is my neighbor's house down the hill.
We started the construction on our house, you'll see in some of the photos,
probably about 6 to 8 months before he started, and then he brought in a crew of four Amish guys, and they built a log cabin down here in about 3 months.
And I continued with my house. It took us about 2 years from when we broke ground to when we moved in. So they moved a little bit faster down there. So we started excavating here. This is the great question. We'll get into that.
This is standing on this
from the house here.
If you were to imagine standing out here on the deck, looking
east, southeast, this is the kind of the hillside that's sloping up here. The house sits on the north side of this hill, so it's. Generally speaking, it's more favorable if you're on the south side, so you can have the southern exposure of the sun. So we actually get a little bit more shade than average, just because the slope is on the south side, which is actually kind of nice because it keeps it naturally cool in the summertime without really having to use too much AC. So here's the excavating into the side of the hill. You can see, to your point, a certain amount of topsoil here, about 2-3 in places, maybe 4 feet. But once you get down below that, there's some stones, but then larger bedrock buried kind of like within that layer there, which was fortunate because it worked out to where we were able to table the house and have the footing sit directly on the bedrock, which is kind of like the ideal scenario in a lot of regards, because within that bedrock, there's a lot of cracks and fissures. So the lot drained very well. Like, you wouldn't have a scenario where you'd have like water up against your foundation that would in most cases kind of work its way into the house. In this case, it would kind of perk down through the stones before it would really attack the foundation. So it was favorable. This is the drive coming up here on the left-hand side of the house over on the right. And then here's you can see here some of these sassafras trees over and through here. This is a large maple, which was one of the largest trees in the area. So we kind of situated the house so that that back deck has the canopy of this maple kind of coming up over top of it, which provided some nice cover. But then also these sassafras, line of sassafras over here from that deck created just a visual kind of sculptural element to the lot. And here they are here. Kind of buried them a little bit from the dig my excavator did, which is not ideal, but fortunately they were able to weather it. Some more images here of the excavation. And then after, in this excavation, some of these bedrocks that we were coming through, we ended up tabling it up here for a crawl space in the back of the house, because we hit this rock, and then the main basement level here in front. And so some of these rocks that we pulled out, we ended up stacking down at the front of the drive. And this was really the first kind of construct that we did with the house after excavating, was kind of stacking these rocks. So it was kind of like a little foil to kind of like kind of warm up to getting into the construction of the house. So it was kind of like an exercise in form and this type of thing. Interesting enough, this is a photograph from when, at the time, this one was just taken 2 days ago. And so you can kind of see the moss growth on the rock, as well as some lichen, which is interesting just to see where, again, these natural things kind of adhere or choose to kind of propagate on the surface. So with that,
I'm going to, as we go through here today, just for your orientation, I'm going to show some of the drawings. These drawings were what I submitted for the building permit, which now that as I was kind of preparing for this lecture, looking back at this, hadn't looked at them in years, I'm really surprised that they gave me a building permit because there's so little information here. There's certainly almost no information related to the building code. So it's the building inspector really cut me a break. But on this is the basement level floor plan here. Two of things. One, I had a series of steps. Because of the grade change, I didn't get a survey when we started construction of the topography. So I didn't. I was estimating how much fall there would be from the one side to the other side of the house. And so I laid out in the plan some steps to be able to kind of adjust once we got out there. You know, if you remove some steps or add some steps. As it turned out, we didn't need the steps at all. It just walked straight out. It wasn't as steep as what I was expecting. And then also this wing over here that was opening up just to bring more light in here. This is where we were going to have our cars parked, like a car park exterior as opposed to a garage. And then you come into the basement from here. This was just to kind of open up and allow more air and light to get in. This ended up turning to a kind of like a true rectilinear form, just to simplify the construction to lower some cost. The building permit was issued on the 10th, or I'm sorry, the 8th of October. Yes. Very good. Good eyes. So this was in 2002. So we started excavation actually before we had the building permit in hand. And then we started forming the foundation. You can see here the rebar that was going into the footings. All this formwork is to receive the concrete for the footings. And you can see here where it benches up. This is the main basement level here, and then up into the crawl space up to the right here, kind of stepping up into the hillside. Also of note, these bars that are coming up vertically are where the foundation wall will ultimately arrive. Beyond that, you can see this expanse here bar horizontally, and that's to create an extension of the foundation. So that way, once this is backfilled, all of that hillside will kind of be weighted down on this footing, and that's to kind of prevent it from not only sliding laterally, but also overturning as that hillside kind of presses against the side of the foundation wall. You can see some more images of it here. So this along here would be where the basement wall will ultimately be built.
How much concrete you put in there?
Quite a bit. I don't have that off the top of my head.
Question?
Yes.
As far as how you prevented the hill from subsiding into the house, is that something they taught you in architecture school, or you just knew that?
No, in school, you take what they refer to as structure classes, various types like steel, concrete, and so that would be something that they would teach you, as well as also materials. They have material classes, assembly classes, how materials go together. Those are all kind of part of the course load.
You get things that you have to take to an engineer?
So I try to do the engineering myself on my work. If I get into something that I'm a little bit worried about, I'll have a few of my engineer colleagues kind of look over my shoulder and take a look at it. Occasionally, if I don't want to kind of bear that liability, then I'll just completely give it to them altogether. But that's only in 20-some years happened, I think, one or two times. So I did all the engineering here on them myself, and so far it's worked out. Here's, you can see the concrete pumper truck coming in, pump it up to the, my framers didn't want to use wheelbarrows on the hillside, so I kind of sympathized with them. So this is the concrete being pumped up and placed. Which is a pretty, it's a good workout. And then this is the site plan that went in again with the permit set. This is the cul-de-sac here, turnaround where we're located. This is our lot, this kind of triangular pie shape. This is my neighbor's lot here. His log cabin sits right here that you saw in the photograph before. So this is our house. It's about 300 feet off of the cul-de-sac, our drive. And the other thing of reference here is this light blue line is our sanitary sewer line that comes out of the house. There was an existing sanitary line here that ran down. And so we had actually, through his property, we had an easement right away to be able to get down and tap into it through his backyard. So then after the footings went in, we got into the block. We did a block foundation, which interestingly enough, so before I was in Los Angeles and then in graduate school, I was up in New York. And then even before going to school, I grew up in Ohio. And so in those three states, it's very hard to find a block layer. Almost all foundations are poured concrete. And then as I did some investigation, when I moved to Pittsburgh and I couldn't find too many concrete subs, and pretty much everyone laid block, I came to learn that Pittsburgh is one of the few places left in the United States where foundation work is primarily block work. And I think it's a holdover from the unions, strong union presence here. But that said, had I had my preference, I probably would have poured the foundation. But in any event, the block went in. It's what's called an ivy knee block. It's 12 inch thick, wide. And the ends, it's kind of like an H shape with where the ends are kind of lopped off, so that way you get these open cells as you lay them. It makes it easier to pour concrete and fill it. And then you can see also down inside the concrete, you can see rebar that's run not only vertically through it, but also lays. It's got these little slots where you can lay them in horizontally in the courses. Again, just so you end up, essentially what you end up with is a concrete wall with the block becoming kind of the formwork that holds it until the concrete sets up. So it's the end product is very similar to a poured foundation.
Which do you think is better?
They have advantages and disadvantages, both of them do. But I'd still kind of lean towards the poured. You can see also here the footing that comes across, and then this pier that it sits upon to kind of make this leap down. This in order to kind of tie them all together and make the upper footing kind of engaged with the lower footing structurally. So the wall climbed. We ended up, because of the slope of the hill, we ended up doing 15 courses, 15 or 16 courses, which gave us a pretty high basement, which is nice, as opposed to a traditional low basement you might end up having. This is kind of a view down from below. You can see again the rock in the hillside.
You know, if you just look at that, you'd think it was a fairly
exactly
normal house.
That's right, and that was the intent. Is that I knew that this was all going to be out of sight, and so I kept the corners square. You know, kept it as simple as possible because I didn't want to spend any more money necessary on the basement to try to preserve the budget for the up, all the stuff happening up above ground.
What do you wall?
Exactly. So this is that kitchen wall that has the five windows in it. It's got a curve to it.
Sir, are you the general contractor?
I was, yeah. Had I worked with a general contractor, I probably would have been paying 20% to 30% premium just because of the. You know, they probably, I'm sure, had not done something like this before. And so just to cover themselves, they would. And so acting as myself, I could kind of take that risk and save quite a bit of money. I hired out the subs individually and acted as the general contractor.
Are the walls of the house acting as sort of retaining walls for the hillside?
They are, exactly. So this side over here all retaining. And also, to that point, I had the curve in because the kitchen wall was going to have a curvature to it, and so I wanted that to sit directly on a foundation, so the curvature was placed here. But you can see in other portions, here I clipped the corner as opposed to having it squared off. In this case, you know, ideally I would have wanted to curve it like this, but this was out over that deck where we removed the studio, and so I could kind of hide that within the deck structure. But this angling here makes this connection much stronger with the weight and the thrust of the hillside on it. And so that, in addition to some pylon piers that are through here, all that is to kind of build in that strength, because most of your load is coming from the left side coming down the hill. One other point here, started the house probably at the worst time of the year. It was like right at the tail end of summer. I mean, generally you want to kind of break ground early in the spring, you know, just as the snow's breaking, so that way you can kind of take advantage of that summer and fall and kind of get everything under cover before the winter hits. It's usually the way you want to structure it. As it turned out, the timing of it, we were breaking ground at the end of summer, and so we were into the winter when we were laying the block, which is not the ideal time to be laying block or pouring concrete for that matter. So fortunately, we got the walls up before we got our first real heavy snow that you're seeing here. But we didn't have the cells filled with the concrete because at this point, there was one that was still open. We could have got sourced it, but I decided not to pour it and hold off until the spring just to pour it in more favorable temperatures. Here's the walk out. You can see from the basement that goes out to the carport. We ended up, the reason why we didn't have the steps here and the slope is we ended up building up the drive and raising it up more than what kind of the natural terrain was to eliminate the steps on the interior. So these are the kind of, like I said at the beginning, some of these changes that you make as you go along and you say, well, you know, it'd be more advantageous not to have a set of stairs inside the basement. And, you know, take that trade-off of the expense of building the driveway up. Here we were setting the first steel beams. Again, not the ideal conditions to be setting steel with ice and snow on the, especially even walking on them, you know, not necessarily safe. We brought a crane out to help them set them. Also, note so I had these spaced about 6 feet apart, with the intent of putting down steel decking and pouring the first floor as a concrete slab. I was going to use radiant heat inside the heat house, which works best in a concrete slab. And so that was the intent when we designed it. But then when we got around to actually building it, I ended up foregoing the metal decking, and I ended up pouring the concrete on a wood deck. And so here you can see actually the wood plates being placed down to receive the joists. So that was a change as well, and it was primarily because I didn't want to hold up the project. I knew that I'd be waiting for weeks or months to get concrete, and I wanted the framers to keep going. So we switched to the wood frame, which you can see here.
So there are no concrete floors there.
No, actually, on the wood frame, we ended up pouring the concrete, but we went with a thinner slab, just enough to kind of get the radiant tube in. It was about 2 to 2.5 inches, as opposed to like a 4-inch slab that you would do on a metal deck traditionally. Here's our oldest son, who was 6 months at this time. He would come out to the job sites with me. And then once we got the first floor deck down, we put up our steel posts. Started to take the glue lambs and place those on top of the steel posts. This would be the structure of the house, would be this kind of frame, this grid of these beams, and this would be supporting the second floor. And you'll notice that the grid, all these connections are right angle connections, except for this one right here that kind of comes in at a 45. But again, I had a series of 3 rows of these beams and tried to keep this rigid rectangular connection, again, just to simplify it, make it easier to for the connections themselves, because then I could use a stock type bracket. But then I turned it on a 45 degree relative to the footprint, so that way it's a little less noticeable. It disguise it a little bit more visually once you're inside. You can see it here, you can see the foundation is kind of orientated here, and the grid is kind of just turned 45 degrees. Uh, Here you can see that as the beams come across, there's a gap here where they don't continue across. That's the opening at the center of the house that goes for the staircase up to the second floor. So here's the first floor plan. You can see in the dark blue here, these glulam beams. You see the center spiral staircase here in the center that interrupts that middle row. And then the second floor plan that sits on top of that here. With the idea, once you get to the second floor, it's this progression in the basement, this rectilinear form. You get a little bit of that in the first floor. This is, an open floor plan. The perimeter has some curvature to it, but it kind of works its way back into, back in here is kind of the laundry and pantry, which does, on the first floor, still have that basement coming through. But then as you get up to the second floor, it's become almost completely circular and round in form, except for the one hall bath for the two boys that's a traditional rectilinear format. Again, just a cost-saving measure. We could use kind of like a standard tub shower unit. And so all of these connections, you can see, again, the posts, all these were made at right angles, but then at the deck that sits atop it, you can see that those would cantilever out from these beams so that we could create the footprint that's irregular and could really kind of do whatever it needed on top of this grid. This is the opening into the staircase. This is that back area where the pantry laundry is. This is kind of like a low ceiling that then opens up. But you can see here from this low ceiling, it kind of disengages from the second floor, and these are the circular rooms of the boys' bedrooms above. So you can see how the joists kind of extend out beyond this grid to whatever length they need to create that radius. And then you can see here, these are the kitchen windows down below here. This is that curved foundation wall that's supporting the kitchen wall.
So your framers kind of got it.
They did. They were very good. In fact, this guy here, his name's Al. This was the head framer. This guy, Al, was his right-hand man. Both of these guys were carpenters more than framers, which is really what you want in a framer, because then their attention to detail is much sharper than just kind of a rough framer. Al was even more than a carpenter; he was like a cabinet maker. So he ended up actually having to leave the job before the house was done because he was having nightmares at night from the house. And so as we'll see here, when we get into the walls, all of the walls, since the structure is kind of post and beam, it's a very traditional structural system, these kind of post and beams, with then, again, all of the floor decks and the roof decks cantilevering out beyond the post and the beams. We put up the floors and the roof, and then we came back and filled in the walls after it. So the walls are acting very like a commercial wall, curtain wall. Where there's no load on it, they're literally hanging off of the floor and the roof structures. But since they all angled in different directions, and each one, it wasn't like you could rip off, cut that angle and just, you know, knock out a series of studs that you would with a typical wall. Each one had to be measured and angled and cut, and so it was very labor intensive. And it worked out to where at each end you have six different cuts on each end of the stud. And so you had basically 12 cuts per stud, and that drove Al crazy. So, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, Bill told him, he says, well, you know, they had another smaller project that was going on at the same time. He just kind of moved them over to that and said, it's not worth, you know, losing sleep.
Can you look at over here on the right? Is that just that framing? Is that just sitting there?
No, that's a window. We're going to get to that here in just a moment. So So this is the basement foundation that's coming up through it. This is before the backfill goes in. Eventually the grade will come up to this orange line here that's in for the backfill. And this is the second floor that's kind of coming up and rising above. Here's that pantry that we saw below is under this kind of low roof. The idea is that this roof comes down right to grade, kind of comes,
kind of tucks that whole backside of the first floor into the hillside.
Is that insulation on the concrete?
It is, yeah.
How thick?
That is about an inch, 1 inch. So it's not a huge amount of insulation. It's primarily there because underneath that is the waterproofing tar. And it's primarily just to protect that tar from during the construction process from getting nicked and dinged. But it gives you a little bit of insulation value. It also is drains as well. It's got like a perks.
Is it tough and dry?
It is. So one of the strategies that I also was trying to work out, if you remember from the earlier lecture when I was looking at the little bubbles in fluid, you can see a little bit of that in here. And also just the relationships of these rooms and the way they organize are based on some of that geometry in those bubbles as far as the size and the proportion and the way that they interacted or the way that they joined. But one of the strategies I wanted to employ was true radiuses, circular radiuses here. And then also bring them together where they engage in a fluid manner. So that way you get these intersections or the relationships between them become very mathematical or regular, so to speak, as opposed to kind of like a free line that's not regular, not based on a math or numbers. And this creates a certain amount of, despite the fact that the floor plane is kind of all over the place, it creates a certain amount of solidity to it. Just because of the fact that the line very naturally kind of transitions along that in a mathematical way. So that was intentional. Here we can see the window aisle here, putting the windows in on the these. So this wall is a plumb wall where it's goes straight up and down perpendicular to the floor. So that connection, these only require a single cut at the end as opposed to six. But despite the fact that it's laid out on a radius in plan, so this was again, this kind of this transitioning. I wanted the house to have this feeling where coming from the ground, it had a simpler geometry, but then as it worked its way to the second floor, that geometry became much more complex with the walls leaning as opposed to being plumb. So this is this as well as two other smaller areas in the house are really the only places we have this kind of plumb condition. Here, this being here, a small little section where we have a series of windows, and again, plumb to here, and then you can see it adjacent to the living room walls that are coming in, not only at an angle, but you can also see they're torqued. You can see how as this stud carries to the next stud along here, you can see how at the top it's dipping in and at the bottom it's fading out. So it creates along the plane surface, it's creating this twist. And this goes back to that first model, if you remember, this idea of taking this arc and laying these straight members on this arc. And then by doing that, it kind of creates this kind of twisted plane just through the geometry of that following that arc. And so that was the idea here, was that even though these are straight studs, or were pretty straight, the fact that they're following a curvature on the top and a curvature on the bottom, which are kind of those arcs in that study model, creates a plane that ends up having a twist to it that give a little bit more dynamic nature.
Could the framers follow that from your drawings, or was this more craft?
They could. And so so the floor plans that I showed didn't have that information on for the building permit's sake, but then I created a construction set of documents in addition to the permit drawings, and those had the information on it where I tried to, as best as possible, calculate all those angles for the top and the bottom of each stud, and I labeled that on the floor plans themselves so they could kind of go as a reference from that. But as my framer would tell me, it wasn't close in some cases. And so, but at least it gave them a place to start. Again, trying to minimize the labor. And then, so to your point, these were the window frames. And so the sides of the windows had, again,
straight members, that then the window, the glass, I decided, you know, to keep the glass flat. And so you have, in this case, it's a 6-foot diameter window. You have a pretty large area that's a flat piece, and so you can see the frame here that the window follows, and then that frame is kind of cocked slightly to the angle, because this, the angle of the wall is kind of is torquing as it comes across. So like here, this flat frame of the window protrudes on the outside on the right side, where it comes in on the left side. What's that?
The lumber looks really good.
It is. I was, yeah. And so,
terrific stuff.
Being from Southern California, I got really spoiled out there, because the lumber on the West Coast is phenomenal. You would get framing lumber on the West Coast that literally had no knots in them, and it was unbelievable. But I was pretty pleased with the lumber that we got out here. It was pretty nice material. In fact, I was half jokingly with the framers, I said, you know, I probably could have saved some money and got like a grade lower in the framing lumber, because even if it had some warpage to it, I mean, it didn't matter, because it would kind of, you know, accentuate the house. But yeah, it was pretty good stuff. And so here you can see the main living room here. And again, so you can see the foundation down below at right angles here. We also clipped this corner in the basement, is similar to the opposite side of the house. And so I'm transitioning from a 45 degree angle here on the foundation that the first floor is sitting on to the second floor, which is a true radius. And so the studs here are each one is kind of like attaching at the top here along this piece, but then it's coming down to a straight line at the bottom. And so just the curvature on the top and the straight line on the bottom is going to create that warpage in the surface plane of the wall. Here you can see the process. They would locate a point where the stud would attach the bottom and at the top, pull a string and measure the angle with the string. And then they would measure it with a tape to get the length.
And then they would cut it, hopefully once, and then they would put it in.
You can see the connection at the floor, which generally the floor was a pretty simple cut. I mean, you had the angle cut, and generally speaking, we tried to keep the studs plumb going up, and so it would be a 90 degree cut across it as well. We also got these metal plates that you could lay out to the curvature, and that gave you something to kind of like tuck your foot of your stud against.
This was a new product that had just come to market. I was able to get the manufacturer of this to donate it, kind of like in exchange of using the house for their product literature. And then here's the top stud coming into the ceiling. So you can see the joist here running here, and then this circular piece that's between the joist, and so it would kind of tuck into, anchor to this circular piece, but in some cases you'd be having to kind of notch around the joist. And so this is one of the more complex kind of tie-in that you would get. It'd just be the nature of, you know, where this would lay out. You can see the marks here. I had figured out the spacing, and the spacing would vary too. Like it might be, in this case where it was going along the linear, it might have like a 16 or 18 inch spacing at the bottom, but at the top, because it's narrow, it's circular, and it's leaning in, it might be like a 12 or 14 inch spacing at the top of the ceiling. So I worked out all that math, put it on the plans. But depending on, you know, as they did their layouts, sometimes, you know, you'd be in a situation where you just couldn't avoid some of the framing that you'd have to work around. And so you can see some of these dynamics. This is in the entryway, as we're kind of, our back's right at the front door, looking into the living room here. And so I wanted to kind of take the wall coming off the front door, which had a curvature to it that kind of received you, but then take it around this point and kind of open it up, and then really make this a dramatic kind of lean, just to make this a figural point, kind of playing off the 90 degree angle of the support column that's kind of in the room.
and bring this down to a point, just to accentuate the figure. And so you can kind of see how that point works, and the window sits up against it in the living room here. So then we receive the LVLs on the second floor. The first floor we used glue lams because we were going to expose the beams, and so I wanted a nicer appearance. The second floor we were going to, again, to save on costs, we just used standard construction grade LVLs, and then we covered them in drywall. So they're exposed beams, but they're covered in the drywall finish. So it saved a few bucks. So again, all these posts went up, and then the beams went on top, and then these beams would be supporting the roof plane. So like as an example, here's the two boys' bedrooms here sitting next to each other. And they have one low beam and one high beam that then the sloping roof deck would sit on top of. Here's the low and the high beam on the master bedroom here on the back side. And then again, a similar thing with the high and low beam here on the closet, and then a high and a low beam in the bathroom. And then this is the roof plan. So you basically had these three major kind of roof planes, and then a smaller one that was over the entryway for the closet. And then infill between them was a flat roof that was a little bit lower. So that way, kind of like the geometry of the sloping planes could be more accentuated. And so then those were then placed on top of the beams. Again, same strategy with them cantilevering out from those beams, the high and the low beams that support them, so that way you could create the circular profile, which was a little tricky. You can see, kind of like in the long direction, these roof rafters would extend out, but then on the side where you had the circular, you had to, those would be extending kind of perpendicular to these, so you had to bring those back in a certain amount for the cantilever to kind of offset it, so that would kind of tie in and create like a sub smaller beam that would drop, so that way it could receive those. And then like where between the bedroom and the bathroom where the two planes came together, this was a little tricky. Because they just the elevations, they ended up kind of like conflicting or coming together, which I thought added some interest visually with the bedroom one much higher, kind of more prominent, disengaged. So that intersection where they came together needed to kind of be worked out. And then you can see beyond that, you can see the flat roof here a little bit lower. The idea was to create kind of a Corbusier roof garden deck. And so I had this is about waist height, so that way you could go up on the flat roof and kind of have the view. And so once the roof was on, we just started filling in all the wall studs, kind of making that span between the top and the bottom.
Why are some of those roof members white?
So I had them, we had them paint the wood before we put it up, just to help protect it until the final material went on.
Okay.
Just kind of pre-treated, which is also why that second floor was that white deck. It was a weather grade, like the sheathing was a weather grade sheathing, but you know we put a primer on it just to kind of an extra belt and suspender, because we knew it was going to be a while till we got it closed in. And actually, to that point, these eaves that would then get exposed eventually were painted, and that's actually the only paint that we used on the entire house. All the other colors were integral to the plaster material. These the glue lams were stained,
On site or before?
Before. Yeah, we on site.
Do they have like a veneer on the bottom there where you glue together? Is there like a veneer underneath?
Yeah, the glue lamps, they're horizontal, the layered horizontal, inch and a half layered laminations. You can see them right here.
Okay.
So it's like a standard stud width. I think they were 5.5 inches. All of the metal bracket bolted stuff would be exposed in and outside the house. Here's some of those connections. A lot of bolts.
Are those all stainless steel?
Actually, we got a bad batch. They were supposed to be all stainless steel. We got a few that were galvanized. So we ended up like the ones that would be exposed, and then we stuck the galvanized. The upper ones on the second floor would all be covered in drywall, so we kept the stainless ones on the lower level. Again, you know, all of these joints with so many, keeping them at right angles enabled us to use like a standard stock bracket, for example, as opposed to a custom-made piece. All these things, you know, all these were ways to just try to keep the cost, overall cost, down to a minimum. And so it's kind of just the craft of using stock materials, which I try to use throughout the house. But still be able to end up with a design that ends up being not a stock type design. Here's a bird nest. We have these outcroppings on the house where these beams kind of go out, and we have roughly about a dozen birds' nests that every spring that like sit out on the outcroppings. So it's kind of a trade-off from the trees we cut down. And so here, this is where these two roof planes came together on the top here. And so the decks kind of had to finger in kind of almost in a woven pattern, finger this together. You can see kind of like the beam of the structure of the one bedroom and then the beam structure of the bathroom where they intersect. And so it's, you know, the radius of these coming in and, you know, fitting it together as they fit, as they kind of intersected. With that, we're running a little bit over. I'm going to take just a 5-minute break here, and then we'll kind of resume with the second half.
If you had a chance to do it again. Did you raise this kind of a little bit?
Or did you? No. When I was setting the heights, like these beam heights, you know, which drives where this is. That's right. Yeah. I initially I actually had them like the bedroom where they did not intersect. I raised these beams up so the whole thing just came up. I kept the slopes the same. But then as I was working through in the model, I decided to drop it down and actually have them intersect because I thought visually it made a little bit more interesting dynamic.
That's right.
Yeah. So I tried to limit it to one case so that way the framers wouldn't give me too much trouble. But I thought visually it worked a little bit nicer by doing that. So, but initially the design was avoiding those conflicts.
Oh, you don't want to bring a square. That's where it's just very close.
Where is it? It's where.
Six cuts to a stud?
Yeah, they. What's that?
In order he left.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was. Cabinetry, you can do that, but framing?
Yeah, it was kind of nuts. And then, you know, when you figured out how many studs you had, I mean, it definitely was exhausting.
Was it difficult to source the subcontractors and the people that worked?
No, it was actually, that was, one nice thing about it is that because, you know, so I had the model when I showed, you know, when I met with the subs. So they could very easily kind of see what they were getting into as opposed to trying to interpret it from drawings. And immediately, like the subs, when they see the model, they either were like, you know, would run away, or they would be all excited, their eyes would light up. Yeah. And so it made it very easy to figure out who you wanted to work with, because, and then on top of that, like when they got excited, they would just kind of bring their A game to the everyday, like you didn't have to motivate them to do their best work. And so, because they want, you know, they saw this as an opportunity to really show off, and they knew that, you know, it was going to be something that they would be able to, you know, have pictures on their phones and show people for, you know, some time to come. And so, yeah, I mean, I did only have a few subs to kind of talk to because I was still kind of new to Pittsburgh, so I didn't had made a lot of connections yet. And so there, you know, I only had maybe one or two electricians, one or two plumbers. And fortunately, pretty much all the trades, you know, of the people I did know, at least one of them, you know, was excited and wanted to do it. So it wasn't a problem. That I kind of thought was, that in addition to the building permit, I thought were going to be my two biggest hurdles, and both of those went pretty smoothly. So I got really lucky. Where I did get a hiccup, which I didn't expect, was the insurance. I had a real hard time finding somebody that would insure the house, because they houses are generally insured. They fall into three camps: either a traditional house, what they refer to, I forget what they actually call the second term, which is a, it's kind of like a non-traditional house, which would be anything from like a log cabin to a geodesic dome or something like that. Even a geodesic dome type thing, I mean, is kind of radical as that is, and you don't see them that often. It's still kind of like a basic geometry. I mean, this, you know, was even beyond that. And so then the third camp falls into what they refer to as non-conforming, which basically means there's nothing you can kind of compare it to. So from an insurance standpoint, they couldn't do a comparable estimate. The only way they can insure it is do a replacement cost. And then even that they were struggling because they had no idea what it would cost to replace it, because, you know, they had, you know, most of the people at these insurance companies had not built anything like this before or knew anyone that had built something like that before. So they couldn't even get a number on it. So they basically were kind of at my, you know, my budget of what I was planning to spend was kind of like their starting point. But they don't like, you know, insurance companies or banks. Bank was a little tricky too. But they generally don't like to kind of take the information from you. They want to kind of drive that themselves. So the insurance was tough.
Matt, did you just work on your house for the 2 years?
No, I was working on other projects because I had to pay the bank and the insurance. So I would come out in the mornings before I go to my other job, and I would meet with the subs that were working that day, kind of like answer the questions they had from the previous day, you know, so that way they at least had, you know, 8 hours worth of work without questions. And then I would meet with them again at the end of the day, you know, just to kind of see how things went. So I'd go out before and after at the, each day, and through the process, basically how it worked.
How long did framing take?
It took a while. Yeah, I'm thinking that's what it was. Let me see here.
Let me guess.
So we set the steel beams on the foundation, which is when we started framing. Those were set on January 28th in 2003. And then we, the walls were completed in July of 2003. So that was 6 months. That's not bad.
So here's the bathroom. Here's an example. You can see the first floor or the second floor deck and the roof deck, again, supported by this kind of traditional post and beam structure. And with the cantilevers coming out, and then the walls would then come and infill and create a perimeter spanning between the two decks. Here's again those connections, typical connection where the wall studs come up. And you can see, you know, we tried to locate them between the rafters so that way you have fewer cuts and fewer kind of intersections. So in most cases you could get, you know, you get a plumb cut at the top. But it would still be coming into the roof plane at a slight angle. You also hit this at another angle. But so this, in this case, you had four cuts on the end, as far as four angles that you had when you made the cut that you had to kind of figure out. But that would be kind of considered, you know, an easy cut because you and getting most of them to kind of fall in here to where they're not intersecting with the rafters to where then, like you saw in that earlier photograph, you would get into a little bit more geometry.
What was the shim budget?
Actually, so that was, because they were both carpenters, we really didn't do a whole lot of shimming. And that's partly why he went crazy, because he would make the cut, he would put it up in there, and if it wasn't a tight fit, you know, he would just get another board and he'd do it again. And I kept telling him, you know, Al, this is rough framing. It's rough. Like, it doesn't have to be a tight fit, you know, but he was, you know, a carpenter more than a framer. And so he wanted it to be tight without a shim. And so, you know, so the house is built very well. It's very tight. Like, all of the framing worked out great. And it took a little bit longer because of that, a little bit more material because of that. And obviously a little, lot more frustration because of that. But it, at, you know, on balance, living in the house for, you know, the rest of my life, it was kind of worth it at the time.
Matt, if you go, don't mind going back one. It looks like this bottom part of the deck is all screwed, right?
Down here.
Yeah.
I think they were nailed. They might have been screwed. I can't remember. It's been 15, 20 years. It's entirely possible. So this was, like, again, the typical window insulation, kind of like spanning between the track and the top, two sides, and then creating kind of like this flat plane to receive the window tucked into it. So you got these eyebrows kind of above and below as a result of it. The geometry was pretty nice because, you know, this is literally, you know, find the center, put a string on it, score it, and cut it, you know, like, so it was, you know, once they got the deck down, it was a pretty easy to get it at that point. So in section here, this is the spiral staircase, which is kind of located in the center of the house. That's kind of like the anchor point that everything else kind of follows. You can see here in section also kind of like these high and low beams with the walls and the general geometry that was kind of throughout, and also down below here the foundation block with the hillside coming into it. You can see this extension here we talked about before, and then the backfill once that fills in, all that kind of weights this and prevents this from kind of overturning from the hillside coming down. Then we received the staircase from a company up in Maine that kind of made the spiral stair. We ended up, I priced the stair locally, which is you're seeing here, to have this made, and I was able to get it for about a third of the cost from this company in Maine, including shipping, because they basically, it was a company that's all they did was make spiral stairs. They had three sizes. I picked the middle size, and then I designed the whole house around it, so that way I could work with their stock standard size. So that was a huge savings. This was the foundation for the fireplace. Even the fireplace had a little bit of a, the radius opening is not that uncommon, but the back side, the back of the firebox goes to a 45 as opposed to a flat back. So it had a little bit of the mason kind of teased me saying, you know, I couldn't do just a standard fireplace. But this was intended, rather than having a square box like this that the gives you a flat face on this side, that the, all the water coming down the roof comes into that flat face, and you have to build a cricket to kind of divert that water. It's a weak point. And so I always wondered, why didn't you just turn the fireplace 45 degrees so you have like a point that's coming in, it just naturally kind of like splits the water and you don't need that cricket. Now, similar kind of to the strategy of the foundation where I turned it into the hillside at a 45, again, taking all the water coming down through the hill and on top of the hill and just splitting it. And so that's where you end up getting this kind of 45 on the back of the firebox, as well as once it gets up above the roof line, this becomes just like a perfect square with the 45 at the high side. And then so we got here, these were the elevations I submitted for the permit. This also changed quite a bit from what we ended up building. You can see some of the doors and the windows, but like just the framing, you know, like the eyebrows and that kind of thing. Initially, it was gonna be just like real pure geometry, but that, as I found out, was even more complex to frame, and they were already giving me trouble about the studs, so we just really simplified it. That whole kind of eyebrow box was a solution kind of on the fly, just ways to simplify the whole process. We got quite a few of these that actually still keep tormenting us living in the woods. But I find it interesting, at this stage of the game, we're gonna wrap the house in this house wrap, and which is kind of a similar way that these nests are made, which I find interesting. So we took, because of the shape of this, in plan and circular as well as angled, it's difficult to get flat stock material to lay on that because it has to bend in two directions. And so we ended up just foregoing all the sheeting on exterior. I just wrapped the house wrap right on the studs. And then we were gonna apply the plaster exterior stucco over that. And that really, the stucco, the mesh and the stucco would really kind of give a little bit of strength that the sheathing typically would. In some cases, you can see here in the kitchen, as well as some of these walls that were plumb, we were able to put the structural sheathing on because it only curved in the one direction in plan, it didn't curve in two directions. So there were some places we could use sheathing on the house. But then that rigid frame kind of like came and went through the walls, which also added a little bit of variety and interest to the design, accentuating kind of like the curvature of the walls by coming through. So you can see the fireplace chimney kind of working its way up to the roof. Brought in the trenches for the utility lines coming into the house. So this is the electric service on the left. Which, interestingly enough, you know, again, kind of like the right angle sweeps here on the conduits, which is kind of traditional, but then on the longer spans, you get the curvature, trying to weave in through the tree roots a little bit. This is the sanitary line from our house here out of view going down to my neighbor's house through his backyard here, tying into the sanitary now further back. So then we, the roof shingles, we started putting those on the roof at this point, as well as this lower area where the dining room studio was that we eliminated ended up being this exterior deck, kind of like the courtyard, so to speak. And we ended up putting a rubber membrane roof flat on that we then put a traditional kind of wood deck on top of.
What are the shingles?
So the shingles, the beams that you saw in here were quite large because at the time that I sized the beams, I assumed that these would be a true clay tile, Spanish style tiles. Which I was familiar with coming from Los Angeles, and which has quite a bit of weight. By the time I got up to the roof and we ordered the material, this company out of Wisconsin had this new product that was a synthetic made out of plastic. And this was when these synthetic roof tiles that we're familiar with today, these were all just coming to market at the time. So I had a similar scenario where I was able to kind of exchange the use of the house in their literature since it was a new product, and they gave me a huge discount on the material. But that plastic tile was significantly less weight. It went down a lot quicker too, because it was just a matter of, you could cut it with a saw, you know, like these radius cuts around here, you could cut it with a framing saw, as well as put down with just a hammer and nails, as opposed to a clay tile that you have to kind of mortar set in. So it was a labor savings in addition to the material savings plus the weight. And so there's a lot less weight on the roof than what it was actually designed to carry with the size of the beams. This is the front door here. On the right-hand side, the leaves that came out, I ordered, since he had the jig to kind of make this, I had to make an extra one that I used on the master bedroom upstairs. And then here's installing the front door. With it being curved on the hinge side, we had to create these custom-made hinges that act almost like a bank vault, kind of where the door pulls away from the wall. Again, just an accenting feature. So I worked with a local guy that does custom metal work, not only on the hinges. So I sourced him for the hinges initially, but then I ended up using for quite a bit of metal work throughout the rest of the house we'll see here. As you can imagine, the frame of the door was really the tricky part, more so than the slab. And actually, the hinges were a lot heavier than the door slabs, significantly heavier, despite having so much glass, which is usually most of the weight. And the hardware installed. This was the drive that we raised up. You can see kind of like the natural grade down here, and we built it up, tracked it in to avoid the steps in the basement. We used some highway material that you put down underneath it. Here's Oscar. And then at this point, we selected the cabinetry, trying to tie it in the same tone as the beams. Started putting the mesh on the exterior for the stucco, which, as you can imagine, was a lot of fun. Really? You can see, like, this mesh is kind of like, again, sheet good. Like, all of this standard building materials are all, you know, standardized kind of sheet material. And so you can see when it lays on the wall, you can see kind of the overlap as a result of that, to where you're trying to accommodate a standard material into an irregular form. This is the basement. We started the rough in on the utilities, and then started applying the exterior stucco on the exterior, which had a base kind of coat, and then a finish. The finish coat, again, had the color kind of integral to the plaster, so we didn't have to do any. The only painting we did was this green, painted the eaves, the rafters that were sticking out.
What about the texture?
The texture was, so we put down, first coat had one color in it, and then we came back with a second coat that had a different, slightly different color variation, and then what they call skip. This is all put on with a hand trowel. They kind of skip that across to kind of make this irregular modeled look. It gives it, kind of visually, it just gives it a little bit more depth at a distance to the surface than just a smooth kind of uniform color. Especially when you get the light from the filtering through with the shadows from the trees. All of these, like where it changes from like red to yellow, all these lines I drew on the wall, kind of gave them that they would then, you can see here, they would take their stucco to my lines. And some of those, we kind of, after they got it up, we kind of made a few changes, and most of that was just all done by eye. It was in reference to, I don't know if you know Clifford Still, the abstract expressionist from mid-century. His paintings I was fond of, and so it has, to some degree, it has a lot of his kind of aesthetic. You can see here that kind of skip coat going on. But the idea generally, and so the aesthetic was kind of in reference to this abstract expressionist, but it was also these transitions were placed strategically on the form to make it look like almost a natural location where maybe the original house was red, and at some point you put a new color on the house, and that, you know, that's kind of wearing away in places. So that way, you know, gives it kind of like this antiqued or aged kind of a feel to it, was the idea. Of course, in some places, like down here, a little bit more dramatic. Here you get more of kind of Clifford's aesthetic, bringing it down through the window just for the dramatics of it. And then, so this would be done much looking at his paintings directly, as far as, like, in fact, this piece here and this piece here are kind of a direct copy of one of his works. But, like, you know, using, he had, like, in this case, three different colors that he would be creating these forms with, and doing a similar thing. But that, you know, I did fall in love with the base coat, which was just a pure concrete. At one point, I toyed with just keeping it all monochromatic and not adding the color. But my wife kind of prevented that from happening.
You designed it, and you mentioned that, okay, during the process, I changed my mind, I want to do this or that. Did you have much of that?
Oh, yeah. Like as they were putting the base coat on, they got the base coat on, and before we kind of pulled the trigger on the finish coat, we talked for a number of days and weeks about possibly just sticking with a monochromatic kind of, because it, you know, it... it's pretty. It's a pretty nice finish.
What was the thinking behind the strong primary, that red and yellow?
Again, well, so the colors were again. My wife. So it was a combination. We kind of worked together. I wanted to work with just primary and secondary colors strictly, not like tertiary colors. Just to keep it much like the geometry using circles. I wanted to keep it very simple because there's so much going on. I didn't want it to be overloaded and become too eclectic. And so we stuck with the primary colors, like in this case, the red and the yellow on the exterior, kind of bright colors. We brought some of the blues and the purples inside where it's a little more subdued and calming. But then once we selected kind of the reds and the yellows, my wife would actually select the reds and yellows. I brought her like a bunch of different reds and yellows to samples to pick from. Here's another kind of, again, one of these Clifford kind of moves across the backside. And then you can see the fireplace chimney coming up through the roof. This is the that back roof that comes down to grade over the pantry, laundry room.
You have no gutters.
That's right, great point. I wanted to avoid, since we're back in the woods, I didn't want to clean gutters, so I just left them off, and so all the water just sheds off the roof. I've always kind of wondered, you know, gutters seem kind of like, I mean, there's definitely advantages to gutters, but it seems like there's more negatives than advantages in my mind, so I and also a gutter on a curved surface would be a little tricky. And so, yeah, the like, you know, as you can see, the shadow lines, I mean, this all plays off of this. And so a lot of that kind of interchange between them was a lot what I was going for. Speaking of gutters, they had this thing where the code requires you to tie all your gutters into a sump pump that kind of, like, takes that water and perks it down into the ground so it doesn't create, like, these water runoff problems. And so that's despite the fact that I had no gutters to collect the water, I still had to put a sump in to kind of fulfill the requirement.
So you don't have anything going into it?
Not technically, no. I told them that I was going to have kind of like on-ground culverts that would all direct around and funnel in, but it really never connected up. But, you know, when you have four acres, the water kind of naturally finds its way in the ground, without having kind of be told where to go. All the HVAC, plumbing, electric inside was also, as you can imagine, a little bit of a challenge. Like you can see here, for example, the joist running this way, but you can see the curvature of the wall up above where this duct is tying into. And so, kind of like the elbowing and angling they have to do to kind of maneuver a circular, these kind of standard elements are made for right angles and even like the plumbing, for example. So there wasn't really a trade that kind of got off easy. Even the insulation guy, we did a spray foam insulation, but just some of the kind of nooks and crannies, which is why we did a spray foam, because as you can imagine, trying to put bad insulation into this, where you have just the wall, would have been much more labor intensive. Plus, the spray foam has a performs much better as a material as far as insulation.
Plus, it gives you some rigidity.
To some degree, yeah. And so here's the gutters to your question. One of the nice things is you get these really dramatic icicles that come down in the winter. And so one of the things with this staircase, it was a stock item. It also came with a banister that also was made of wood, which initially we planned to use, but then once we got the one arm up, it looked too traditional in my mind, more kind of like mid-century. And so we ended up foregoing that. And we had the guy that made the hinges make some metal railing, and we kind of splurged a little bit since it was the center of the house. We thought it was a focal point. He came up with this design of making the railing kind of reference these sassafras trees that had the kind of the irregular shapes outside. These were a code violation because these gaps here are too large at the bottom. All this was like made on site, grinded on site, stuck together.
Are you able to take the work?
Yeah, that's great work. Here's some of the radiant tubing going in.
You were still new in town. How did you find these
guys? So I was working with a general contractor on my day job at the time. Getting some exposure to some of the subs through their work. Interesting enough, like the tubing is kind of laid out on a grid pattern, but then at some places it kind of becomes a little bit more organic. It's this kind of dichotomy between that the whole house is kind of wrestling with between kind of this irregular rounded form and the rectangular. Then we brought the blue board in for the interior, which in some cases laid against the wall, in the plumb walls, pretty well. But in other cases, as you can also imagine, also the sheet goods, you can see some of the cutting and the piecing together that would happen. And we came up with this strategy where they wetted them at night and kind of like weighted them down to get a curvature kind of built in for the next morning so they would go on the wall a little bit easier. This was like one of these, this is that entry, that kind of dynamic comes to a point. This is one of the more challenging shapes to cover. A lot of these forms are kind of inspired by Sarah's torqued ellipses that we saw in the earlier weeks. His ellipses, the way that they turned in plan, but also leaned. A lot of that is the same vocabulary that I was using in the house. So, the walls feel very much like a similar experience to Sarah's torqued ellipses when you walk through. This is the walk-through closet, and then the master bedroom here, which has got a vaulted high ceiling. The closet here through. This is the plaster going on wet, so it's same technique as the exterior, skipping a color onto it. Again, the color was all integral to the plaster. This was Oscar's bedroom. Since it was in green, took a little more artistry and made it kind of like this natural kind of like leaf, fern kind of pattern. And then the other bedroom for yet-to-be-born second son. And then we also, because of all these windows were round, I came up with a design for a curtain rod because my wife wanted curtains. I had the metal guy make these curtain rods where these would mount to the wall and then the rod would actually come out from the wall and kind of create this kind of volumetric form that would kind of hang. I asked my wife if she could maybe, we could hold off on installing these and live in the house for a few weeks before we put them up, thinking that she might change her mind. which she did. So we ended up not putting any curtains on, especially back in the woods. Also of note, there's two square windows in the house. This is in the boys' bedroom for egress requirement, the one out of a bedroom. All of the circular windows are fixed windows, so we had to put at least one egress window into the two boys' bedrooms. But I did a similar thing on the roof with the skylights. I used, again, a stock square skylight, but then made the opening through the roof circular and try to disguise it to some degree. Again, just to simplify with using stock materials. Now, here's the concrete that we put down on top of the wood deck. We embedded a few shells into the concrete, again, kind of referencing back to some of the origin of the design. This is at the entry. Took the concrete right up to the walls. We didn't do any kind of trim work in the house at all, any base trim, any ceiling trim, any door trim, window trim. It's all plaster returns, so that was a savings by just eliminating the trim work altogether. Had the trim carpenters do the framing instead. But like just the transition of the material, that kind of this sharp profile just really accentuates the lines, the curvature. And then we did, in parts of the house, we did what's called a Venetian plaster, which is a different type of method, a lot more labor intensive, but it burnishes and becomes kind of like a shiny kind of finish, because the Venetians would take mix in some glass dust into their plaster to kind of create this that would catch the light. It's a lot more cost, and so like the front entryway here and a few other key places in the house, we splurged a little bit and had the plasterers do this Venetian technique. So you can kind of see the transition between the Venetian here and the more traditional on the left-hand side, despite the fact that they're in the same color tone. This was in the kitchen. Again, we used the Venetian. And the other nice thing about the Venetian, it also holds up to moisture better. So like in the bathrooms and the kitchen, it cleans up and it holds up much better. You can see actually a good photograph here. You can see kind of the modeling that's in it. It catches the light. This is that hall bathroom on the second floor. Laid some tile mosaic on the one wall around the window that kind of radiate out like a sun pattern. And then this is the wall in the master bedroom where the fireplace from below kind of comes up through. Original design had a fireplace in the master bedroom. And again, we just eliminated it to save on cost. And so then at this point, it just became more of kind of a formal aesthetic element. You can see some of the shell in the stair. The metal work did a custom kind of grate. And then we stained the concrete, modeled the concrete to give it a little bit more of a dynamic color. You can see how much the light kind of catches off of the Venetian plaster. Then we did, the final grading, bringing it up to the house, now that the house is finished. Much the same way we stacked the rocks at the beginning, out by the end of the drive, we took some of the rocks and stacked them at the back at the tail end of the project, kind of like bookended a little bit. The way that I kind of bring guests through to the house, I bring them from the drive through the woods, and so like there's a wood path that brings you down, and then you come down these rock steps and you arrive down at the house from the backside. So these are the stones that we put in. And then we had some carpet in the family living room here on the first floor. And then the second floor is pretty much all carpet. Again, it was a cost savings as opposed to like a wood or a tile or stone finish on the second floor. The thought was,
The first floor was concrete, second floor is carpet, and since we were raising two young boys, they could basically be these materials that could take a beating. And with the thought that, you know, once they're kind of out of the house and they've flown the coop, that maybe then we could take them up and, you know, the concrete, you could lay some nice stone or tile. This is the Capri deck off the back. Oh, so I remember the third thing. She asked for a house that was not your typical house. It's funny how memory works. And so, yeah, so like the structure, the post and beam structure was this regular right angle kind of grid. And, with the irregular kind of rounded forms, it just becomes a foil that it plays off of and accentuates the way it kind of creates these points where the two interact. And so it's, despite the fact that, if I had an endless budget, I could do a structural system like Gary's Guggenheim, that's like these custom forms. But despite that, I actually kind of like the fact that I did have, because it's a subtle way to really accentuate it. If this was a Guggenheim and the structure was not visible because it was all kind of like melded into the wall, the wall would have that curvature, but it wouldn't be as pronounced because it doesn't have this kind of thing it's playing off of.
Kind of looks deconstructionist.
Exactly, yeah. So the cabinets were all stock cabinets. They're laid out on a circular plan, so they're tight on the front, but in the back, underneath the counter, they kind of splay out from each other. Again, trying to work with stock items to be conscious on the budget. And then here's a little nod to Richard Serra, one of his drawings. And then, after we got the house was done, we put in, this is this entry point down at the turnaround. You come through this gate and it kind of leads you through the path. Here's these stones from the beginning that were stacked that takes you through the woods to kind of arrive at the house, kind of like as the house kind of like comes out of the trees and kind of unfolds, as opposed to the drive that comes up around the back way.
Next class.
Yes. So with that, we'll pick up next week with our fifth lecture, which will be on in the 15-20 years since we've been living in the house. We've been using it kind of as a laboratory to where running different types of experience. The biggest experiment being, what impact is a house like this or an architectural space like this going to have on kids being raised in this environment? And so we'll see a little bit of that next week.
Thanks.